Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy,
presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
As the nights get colder, and as the growing number of unhoused Oklahomans becomes evident on sidewalks, in alleyways, and in shanty towns, business at county courthouses across Oklahoma is booming, at least when it comes to evictions. The recent federal shutdown forced some Oklahoma families to choose between food and rent. A Mental Health Association Oklahoma survey of 79 households facing eviction in November found 73% blamed their plight on the loss of SNAP benefits. From children to working adults to seniors, the toll on unhoused Oklahomans is profound, and the solutions from policymakers all too often feeble. For our latest ObserverCast, Senate Democratic leader Julia Kirk and OK policy analyst Sabina Brown join us to take a deep dive into the hurdles and the options that could help thousands of Oklahomans and their families get stable housing, improve their health and well-being, and get on the path to a brighter future.
We're here today with two amazing thinkers, two amazing doers that directly impact Oklahoma politics every day. And when we saw the government shut down in October, I think it really kind of drove home the point for some people that, you know, what the federal government, what government does every day actually has real world impact on the people of the country. And we're starting to see that really seep down at the state level with people who lost support from, you know, social services are in a really bad way. In some cases, you know, we're seeing increasing eviction rates in Oklahoma. People having to make really, really tough choices between food on the table or keeping the lights on and the doors, you know, keeping their homes. So Arnold and I are really happy to be here today with two very, very, very well-read and very active in this area. And so we always start out with tell us who you are and what you do, and we'll get it started. Sabina, you want to go first?
Sure. My name is Sabina Brown, and I'm a senior policy analyst with the Oklahoma Policy Institute, and I work specifically on housing. Oklahoma Policy Institute is a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank, and we work on a broad range of policy areas that affect low to moderate income families.
Senate Democratic leader, and have worked really hard on some of these issues.
Okay, I think you broke up some, Senator, too, there. I don't know.
Well, so, I mean, we've had the pleasure of having Senator Kurt on before, and she's been a guest on Newsmakers, and so we're just really happy that you both have time today, although we're all, like, literally scattered across the country right now, so I'm just glad we could get together. But I'm just wondering, maybe, Sabina, could you maybe kind of recap for us what happened this fall that kind of led us to where we are right now in terms of the unhoused and housing instability?
Sure. So I want to start with kind of before that, even just to kind of lay some groundwork, because I think the first thing that's important for folks to remember is that renters in Oklahoma have been struggling for a while now, and that's not anything new. So about half of Oklahoma renters don't make the annual income, which is about $44,000 per year, to afford a simple two-bedroom rental home. About 7 out of 10 of those extremely low income renters are what we call severely cost burdened, meaning that they're spending more than 50% of their income on rent. And that is important to remember because renters were not well positioned to absorb any kind of loss of income. And now we're facing just massive cuts to support systems. We're coming off of the federal government shutdown. We're seeing decreases in SNAP payments, some people losing SNAP payments altogether. We're p facing potentially massive cuts and changes to really important housing programs. So again, renters in Oklahoma don't have any room to have this loss of income or change in their support system. And we're already making really devastating decisions between putting food on the table and paying their rent. And so as we continue to see these cuts to vital support systems like SNAP and child subsidies, it is putting Oklahoma renters in a really tough position. And we're seeing folks end up with evictions and in, worst case scenario, homelessness.
Senator Kurt, could you talk about some of what's happened at the state level in regards to this situation specifically related to the government shutdown in October?
Yeah, I mean, one of my biggest concerns is that we just didn't have in place the kind of contingencies to help folks weather these challenges. So you've got, people that are living very close to the line, getting, really pretty small amounts of food assistance. And we didn't make sure that they were covered. Really, it was after the shutdown that we heard the governor, beginning to ask agencies about at-risk funding. Well, that's too late. Like, we need these contingencies in place now. I was deeply alarmed that, we didn't have in place a commitment and contingencies for our state employees that are funded through federal money. Some of them, their payments were at risk. So we had DHS employees who got furloughs. It wasn't the lowest paid folks, but I mean, it's not people who are living large or anything. And then we also had DRS employees told that they weren't going to get paid in February. And, to me, that's our state's obligation. We really should be planning for these things. We have big cash reserves, and I'm not even talking about our savings accounts. We have additional appropriated money sitting there that could cover these gaps if we would plan for contingencies. So that's the part at the state level I'm really concerned about.
So there's no planning that, there isn't the serious structural planning that you talk about there that's happening. But it also seems to me that efforts to sort of get the conversation going in some of these areas to kind of get our hands and our minds wrapped around what's really happening with the eviction processes in Oklahoma, because people can get thrown out on the streets a lot faster in Oklahoma than just about any other state, right?
Yeah, I mean, go ahead. Sabina's really she's the pro on this one. I'll talk about legislative stuff after that.
The eviction timeline in Oklahoma is really, really tight. So you can go from being a day late on your rent to being evicted from your home in under 2 weeks. And so that does not leave a lot of room for folks to make up back rent, to arrange for childcare, arrange for time off work to even show up at your eviction hearing, or even just to arrange for alternate housing. And so in just generally, the policy landscape in Oklahoma is really tough on Oklahoma renters. On top of this really tight eviction timeline, tenants in Oklahoma lack some pretty basic protections that they have in other states. We're one of only six states that doesn't protect tenants against landlord retaliation. Meaning that if a tenant complains about a health and safety issue and requests for a repair, like let's say they have like standing sewage in their rental, rather than having that fixed, they could be faced with loss of their lease, increased rent fees, or even eviction. We also have really low eviction filing fees in Oklahoma, and that is something that we know contributes directly to eviction filing rates. So there's a lot of changes that we could be looking at on a state level to improve the eviction process, to improve the Landlord-Tenant Act to help Oklahoma renters stay housed.
Yeah, and I just want to add that, I mean, I've really learned along with her and with other organizations coming together on the challenges that these laws are placing on folks. I didn't understand how bad it was until I had a constituents who were in an apartment complex that had no heat for months. And those folks could not get a hold of their property management company because it changed. Was not the same as the ownership. And they were scared to not pay their rent because they were afraid that they could be evicted. And that's actually true. They could get evicted. They actually have to notify their landlord in a specific way about the repair problem to not get evicted. And that alarms me. And so I think the due process is very limited in the protection. So we passed a bill last year, SB 128. Made it through the House bipartisan with Representative Daniel Payne in the House, and the governor vetoed it. That would have added some time to that timeline. One of the alarming things is folks may just have their paycheck just not timed right with their when their rent's due, and so they might just be getting paid a day or two after that rent, and it might be too late. There's a lot of property management companies that do not accept payments once they've filed. And this kind of mindset is really hard on community and hard on society. I've been trying to point out to my colleagues for several years now, like what it's costing our communities to have this happen. And they seem to empathize very heavily with the property owners and their concerns, which I totally understand. You have to allow people to hold tenants to a standard. But folks being evicted actually really hurts all of us. And I think that's finding that balance. So this year I'm filing a bill, or actually it's filed, a bill that would add weekends and holidays. It would exclude those from the timeline. Currently, literally Halloween, I mean, literally Christmas Day, Thanksgiving Day count towards the eviction timeline, which means when folks can't even get to a bank, certainly can't get rental assistance in those timelines, it really leads more towards eviction.
And can I ask, don't we know that it's not necessarily like for instance, I own a couple rental properties. It's not like necessarily small mom and pop, if you want to call them that, property owners, but there's kind of like these larger like property managers that are really kind of driving this in the state of Oklahoma. Isn't that correct? Like it's like kind of a, I mean I don't want to say it's not a systemic problem, but it's really like kind of like the larger apartment ownership kind of property groups, if that makes any sense. I'm kind of bungling this, I'm sorry, but I mean I know there's been some reporting on this in recent years.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, if you look at the eviction filings, it tends to be like a small number of landlords and property owners that are filing a disproportionate amount of evictions. And I know like when we, when I talk to like smaller like local landlords, like usually they're willing to work with their tenants. Like they don't want to see folks evicted. They understand that, sometimes bad things happen and you miss a paycheck or you have an emergency, and they're usually pretty willing to work with those tenants. But unfortunately, like you mentioned, we have like larger corporate landlords where this is a business model. They're just filing evictions, as soon as someone is a day late. And as we see more property, owned by large corporate landlords, we really need to make sure that our Landlord-Tenant Act and our eviction process is adequately protecting our tenants.
So is that who senator legislators are mostly hearing from then? Are lobbyists for the big property owners, or are they hearing from, folks at the coffee shop who are saying, "Well, I can't get so and so to pay their rent again," or, something along that line?
Yeah, well, I would start that first of all, a whole lot of our lawmakers are landlords. Many, many of them own rental properties. That's been in America a major strategy for wealth creation is to buy property, right? So we have a whole lot of, and I say that with people telling me that directly, people saying that on the mic directly. So we have a whole lot of folks that own property themselves. So they have their own experiences and fears. I've talked to a lot of my colleagues who are landlords who clearly are very good landlords who work in good faith, who give people a grace period, who try to work with them, who still are nervous about any additional protections because they're worried it's going to mean that if they have a tenant who's tearing their place up, that they can't get them out. And it's just very hard to reassure them that's not the case. In terms of lobbyists, when I had a longer timeline proposed, the Apartment Association, which does represent those apartment owners, and the realtors were against it. I trimmed it back. That's how we got to 5 days. And then they went neutral officially. So some of their members might have been lobbying against it, but as organizations, they weren't. So I think they understood that there needs to be some basic protections there. There's a whole lot of mom and pops that call, lots. So, my executive assistant has talked to a lot of angry folks who feel like they should be able to do whatever they want with their property. We've had folks that say they should be able to kick someone out the same day. And so I think we have a real disconnect on expectations for landlords that if you are going into the home rental business, that you there are certain standards you have to meet for the safety and welfare of our communities. And I think that we have to elevate that. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that we as a state are ripe for landlords that exploit is because our laws let them exploit. So I want to reassure good landlords that work in good faith and really do offer a grace period that they won't be impacted. They won't. It's the folks who are exploiting the system that would be. But yeah, we hear from mom and pops. There's a lot of voices against it, and as you can imagine, the people who are for it, generally they're lower income and they're not able to be as active politically. So it's groups that work with low income folks who are advocating for this. But I'll say it's grown. The movement's grown, and Oklahoma Policy Institute's done a great job of bringing people together. Now the city of Oklahoma City is part of the Housing Stability Coalition, for instance, because they're recognizing how much it's hurting their neighbors and neighborhoods and community and economy to have all these evictions. So I think we're broadening that, but I think explaining the urgency to people who are not actively at risk of being evicted is hard.
So my mind is just kind of going back to basically the tax structures that support the system. Because I'm just thinking if you can claim a loss, so I don't know. It's just the overarching financial systems, through taxation, et cetera, in this, renter landlord relationship. My very vague understanding, I mean, I'm gonna get it handed to me in, the next tax system, but I'm just saying, like, it doesn't really support, any sense of grace or grace periods for tenants. Because I just remember talking about this after the 2013 tornadoes, and there was a lot of people displaced because of the destruction from the tornado that spring, and so we tried to do, no, we did do an interim study on tenant rights, and there just, was no palette for it in the legislature. So anyways, but so back to kind of the impact of the government shutdown, freezing really kind of the federal support for these social services, and the state's lack of preparedness in that area. Were there examples of, because I'm drawing a blank here, were there examples from other states that were really like, okay, we got this, right? That were able to kind of come in with assistance to back up what was lost at the federal level. My guess is probably Illinois did. maybe New Mexico, but I'm guessing there. So if do you have exa do we have examples of states that had it together and were ready to respond after the federal shutdown with housing assistance and SNAP sort of things?
I read about Colorado's decisions because
Okay.
Colorado made several contingency decisions. That's the state I followed most closely because I was fascinated that they upfront were working out what will we do if, and they actually even passed legislation with contingency budget gap filling, based on priorities. I think that's what's important is you see states that are
Right.
planning ahead are looking at, okay, well, we can't have the childcare system full because that will cripple our economy. Not to mention keep kids, we need to keep kids safe. So they put in place some of those protections. I don't know about other states. I didn't watch closely.
Yeah, I don't know of any specific examples off the top of my head. I mean, I know there were, but I will add that just generally, that states have taken up a bigger role when it comes to housing and making sure that folks are stably housed. I feel like historically, housing has largely been an issue that has been left up to like the federal government and local governments, and states have kind of played a limited role. But as we're seeing, a housing crisis play out across the country, as we're seeing increased evictions, increased homelessness across the country, I think more states are starting to ask themselves, like, what can we do about it and what is our role in it? And so we are seeing across the country states take a bigger role in, how can they prevent evictions, looking at, their own rental subsidy programs, or how can we spur more affordable housing development. So I think that's a trend that we'll continue to see, and hopefully Oklahoma follows suit.
Do we have a notion yet the actual fallout from the frozen benefits when through the government shutdown and percentage maybe what that led to in terms of a spike in evictions here in Oklahoma?
So I know at OK Policy, we're still looking at the numbers. Like, we still need to look at the full month of November, December to kind of see the full fallout. But I will say there are organizations that have been very active in eviction courts, and have been talking to people, and know that the shutdown and cuts are definitely playing a role in housing stability. The Mental Health Association of Oklahoma just released a report. They did interviews with folks in eviction court, and were overwhelmingly hearing from people that cuts to things like SNAP was directly leading to their eviction. Many of these folks had never had an eviction before. So we definitely know that these cuts and shutdown are affecting people's ability to keep a roof over their head.
But this, I think this system and this month has really shown, it shows some of the gaps in data that we have. It's very hard to be timely. It's very hard to have more information. There's just, very little data that we have. And I know that certainly mental health associations have been working on that. There's neighborhood services organizations starting to do some more data collection on a consistent basis. So I hope we can begin comparing. But in the past, we've been working from pretty old data, and it's hard. All we have is like the name of the owner, the name of the tenant, and the amount owed, which, by the way, are usually not very large amounts. Most of them are about 1 month's rent that's owed. So otherwise, we only know if we do that kind of qualitative follow-up as to what precipitated them falling off that cliff.
I hear a lot of talk though around the Capitol about data-driven decisions, and we want to make data-driven. We're going to follow the data. We're going to, but this is an indication to me that clearly it's not a priority to a lot of people in the State House to do anything about this. But it seems to me that as a state, we would want to be creating mechanisms for having this information in hand so that our elected leaders can make the best decisions possible, right?
I
Yeah.
mean, when you get what, why would you need that when you've just got a bunch of anecdotal information from a house legislature full of landlords? I
Well,
mean,
I
I'm
think
being
it's we
snarky,
count
but.
right. We count what we value, we count what's important. And what you're talking about really with evictions is small claims court. It's just, it's become its own docket for many counties. But you're talking about tracking small claims court. And so I think we've had to have an increase in the nonprofits that are focused on it to build that interest. I hope over time that becomes part of our dashboard for the health of our communities. When you're talking about how do you track the well-being of our communities, that would be a big one that I sure would put on my list.
But also, I mean, if our fine, if our courts are funded through fines and fees, what are the incentives to cut back on these sorts of filings and these sorts of proceedings? Because it's just one more thing that sends, economically uncertain individuals into a spiral. That leads to fees, to another fee, another fee, another fee. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I think this is just the moment where I kind of finally see like this, the eviction process is right up there with, all the fees that, all of our folks that are getting out of prison have to deal with, and just the compounding, debt that is accrues from all of this based on the fact that we have a court system that is not, funded through appropriations.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that in terms of we need to appropriate our courts. I actually can't imagine that eviction filing fees are covering the cost of the staff for this because,
They're
you're
so
not only
low.
talking,
I know you said they're so
yeah, it's so
low.
low, and you're talking about hundreds, staff are processing hundreds. I mean, like in Oklahoma County, hundreds a week. I rode along with Oklahoma County deputy who does some of the notifications. They have 12 full-time sheriff deputies out there just for eviction-related work. So we're paying for 12 full-time law enforcement officers to be the frontline folks who are giving notice, sending, dropping off summons, posting lockout numbers. I literally stood with them while they, changed the locks on apartments, and we're spending public money on that. So it's a huge expense, and there's no way that filing fees are covering that. Plus, those landlords turn out around and try to charge that to the tenant, you know?
Ugh.
I wanted to add, going back to the data point, like data is definitely an issue, but I also wanted to add, like, we do have good data of good housing policy, right? Like there are good national studies that show raising the eviction filing fee reduces the amount of eviction filings. We know that homeless services that focus on housing first, not housing only, but like that first step of getting somebody in stable housing and then focusing on things on treatment works. We know the impact that eviction has on children from national studies. There are study after study showing the negative effects that housing instability and evictions have on children. And that when we make investments in housing, when we invest in things like rental subsidies, that pays off in the long run when we have stable families and children that are stably housed. So we do have data that points us in the right direction. We just need the political will to enact some of these policies that we know works.
Well, and this.
I need to go ahead and step off, but it was great to talk to both of you guys, and I know you guys will finish the conversation. So thanks again for both to see. It was good seeing both of you.
Bye, Marianne. It's good to see you.
Bye. Well, I think this might be a good time to also sort of segue. It's not on evictions per se, but this whole notion of homelessness on, housing affordability, all these sorts of things, and what it does to our communities in Oklahoma. But I can't help but think about Monroe Nichols' proposal in Tulsa for the relatively modest, and I know there are problems with sales taxes. I understand that, and but it was something that was focused on the notion of beginning to tackle the problems of people who are so, they have no place to go. And the city council bigfooted it before it could even get a chance to go to the voters and let the voters decide, what to do. It's amazing to me when you see the spike in evictions, you see the homeless sweeps that the governor ordered, that again, have in my mind haven't done much of anything. And yet there's still seems to be this resistance on the part of elected leadership to do something about it.
I mean, I'll hop in, but it's hard to answer for my colleagues. I think we have a real disconnect where people are not up close to the problems we're talking about. We have a lot of people who maybe haven't lived through that instability or don't have as much understanding of the challenges of getting stabilized after challenges. I mean, like I think seeing the data about what happens post-eviction and how it impacts families and how it leads to worse poverty and more, job instability, worse health outcomes, I think somebody has to know someone or experience that to understand the magnitude of the issue. And then, of course, we have a lot of debates about government's role, right? What is government's role in these issues? Fundamentally, a lot of these things could be improved with better wages, so folks aren't struggling month to month. And that was a really good area of agreement I had with the apartment association folks. Those property managers are very clear that their folks aren't making enough money, and that low wages are a big part of the reason. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not answering for anyone, but I think we have set this system up, this housing system up in a way that it's not focused on families' well-being first.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think there's this idea that folks that are struggling with housing, that are facing eviction or homelessness, are in that position because of some sort of personal failure. That if they would just get a job and work harder, that they wouldn't be struggling. And we know that that is not the case. The wage to the hourly wage to afford a 2-bedroom home is over $20 an hour. If you look at a minimum wage worker, they could be working nearly three full-time jobs and still be struggling. I think it would surprise people to know that you can be working and homeless. Every year, I volunteer to do the point in time count and talk to folks experiencing homelessness. And I have met people that are working. It just doesn't pay enough for rent. So we don't have a problem of people not working enough. We have a problem of, as Senator Kurt said, like wages not keeping up with housing costs, the lack of affordable housing. So we really, instead of looking at this as like personal failures, we really need to be examining the systems that are leading folks to struggle with housing stability.
I can't help but, I mean, I look, I'm an Oklahoman. I grew up here. I chose to come back here, bring my family back decades ago. And but Oklahoma frustrates the daylights out of me because I see the generosity of my fellow Oklahomans in times of crises, the so-called Oklahoma standard. But really, the everyday standard is more like, you're on your own, pal. And I wonder how you begin to change that mindset, that to move it beyond this notion that somehow it is a moral, it's almost like it's a moral failing. Any ideas? I mean, I know
Yeah.
that's
Well, I
probably
think we
not,
have to
it's
start
not answerable.
young. It's not really, but I mean, we have to start young. I yesterday went to a high school event for Generation Citizen, where kids are presenting concerns they have about the community and ideas to improve it. And lots of the students are worried about poverty and issues in poverty, homelessness, youth homelessness, et cetera. Talked about knowing friends whose families are having to live on the couch circuit. But even they, who had so much compassion and empathy for their classmates, were using moralistic language. And so I think we just have to tackle it and point it out wherever we can.
Well, I know time's running short for everybody here, but I'm just curious. This is such a massive problem. You have so many components to this, whether it's wages, it's eviction timelines. You're dealing with mental health issues in a lot of cases. All these sorts of things. Do we have examples that we in Oklahoma and our leadership should be looking at from elsewhere? To how to get a handle on these problems and begin to move the ball instead of just continuing things seemingly to get worse.
Yeah, we certainly do. I think, first of all, like you said, it is a very multifaceted problem, and there's no one single policy solution to it. We know we have a severe lack of affordable housing in the state. We're about 85,000 units short for extremely low income renters. We know that we need to be building more affordable housing to meet the needs. We have an eviction process that needs to be updated and wages. So there's lots of things that need to be fixed to make sure that folks are housed. But like I said before, we are seeing states start to figure that out. For example, North Dakota and Montana are two states that have recently done quite a lot on housing, that have recognized that the lack of affordable housing was a problem and that they needed to take action. They both started with forming housing commissions or a task force to really identify the solutions. They have really gotten involved in updating zoning laws, allowing for different types of housing and allowing for the building of more affordable housing. We've seen states come up with their own rental subsidies programs. So there are lots of examples across the state that we can be looking at. Again, we just need the political will to take action.
And we haven't even
Yeah, and I'll
discussed.
just add, Arnold, I have some kindergarten kids standing outside my door, so I'm
Oh
going to have to hop off. But I want
yeah,
to
you better
say,
get to them.
I will. They're so cute. I just want to say thank you. The work that Oklahoma Policy is doing is really important to the data and to the stories that people need to hear. And I think she's right. Like that, building that political will is part of what we have to do. And I think we've worn people down some on it just over the last couple of years by reiterating, by taking different angles on it, by explaining the problem in economic terms, in social services terms, in as many ways as we can. And I just think we can't quit. So thank you for focusing on it.
All right, well, give all those kindergartners a hug for us, and we're about to wrap up here too. So thank you so much for joining us. All right, so we haven't even talked about one last thing that was on my list here of things. We also have a situation in Washington, right, in D.C., where there are proposals to put limits on rent subsidies. Which it seems to me could even make problems worse, right? I mean,
Yes. So there's been a proposal to cut off rental assistance after 2 years, even if participants still can't afford rent. And that would put over 30,000 Oklahomans, more than half of them children, at risk of eviction and homelessness. Again, there's an idea that folks that are struggling are not working, and that is why they are struggling with housing, but we know that that is not true. About half of these households that would be affected are in households that include someone who works but doesn't earn enough to afford rent.
I guess does this in your mind tie into the state question that's going to be on the ballot in June, the minimum wage question?
I think raising the minimum wage is definitely a piece of it. We know they say the minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2009. Since that time, we've seen rents increase about 60%. The minimum wage was designed to meet basic life needs. It is nowhere close to doing that at its current state. Folks working a minimum wage job need to work nearly three full-time jobs to afford a two-bedroom rental. So raising the minimum wage is definitely a piece of it. It is not the only piece. Like I said before, we know that we definitely need a lot more affordable housing. We need to look at our renter protections and eviction process, but making sure our wages are keeping up with rising housing costs is definitely a big piece of that puzzle.
And that moves us, that at least moves us in the right direction,
Right.
obviously. I'm just thinking, it moves us to what, $15 an hour after a certain amount of time. That doesn't sound like a whole lot of money to me in this day and age. And you think about just the when you go to the grocery store, it's like, wow, we got out for only $100, this time, and or we got out for $100, and that used to be $50 worth of groceries. And it's shocking how things the prices have increased.
Yeah, I mean, average rent in Oklahoma right now is around $1,400. So it is just nearly impossible if you're working a low-wage job. The math ain't mathin', it doesn't add up. There's not enough hours in the day to work to make up that kind of rent. And more we're seeing folks make really hard decisions between rent and food and medical care. And unfortunately, if we don't help correct that balance, I think we're going to continue to see evictions and homelessness get worse.
Well, we're already one of the unhealthiest states in the country by most metrics.
Yeah.
How do you say the plural? But at any rate,
That's a good question.
so yeah, it all feels good. So what happened? One last thing, and I'll get out of your hair because I'm taking up your time today. But one of the things that struck me about the Mental Health Association's research. Recent research where they went and they identified that I think they said 79 families, if I remember correctly, that had been notified or were part in the eviction process in November, part of this issue, or now maybe it was, yeah, I guess it was 79 households, but it seemed like three quarters of those said that they were absolutely convinced that the loss of the SNAP benefits were led directly to their eviction because they did have to make that choice. And it leads me to wonder, what happens to these folks? I mean, not everybody has somebody they can, go sleep on their couch or whatever the case might be. In reality, what is happening, to hundreds and thousands of people across the state of Oklahoma who suddenly are on the streets?
I think first of all, it's important to remember how much overlap there are in these federal support programs. So, like nationally, of people who receive housing assistance, three out of four are on Medicaid, and two out of three receive SNAP. So when you cut one program, it really affects everything else. It has a domino effect. I'd mentioned before that, the average rent is somewhere around $1,400. The average SNAP benefit to an Oklahoma household is $332. So missing that SNAP payment is, about a quarter of your rent. That's really hard to make up. And the people that are most affected by these cuts are children, seniors, folks with disabilities. And we know that the de devastating effects that housing instability has on children. There are many studies that show the numerous impacts on mental and physical health, on school performance. It affects their income as adults. So what we do today really has long-standing ramifications. Evictions already affect young children and infants more than any other age group. So again, if we continue to take these support systems from our most vulnerable, we are going to be feeling the long-term effects of that.
And those are the sorts of things that we're talking about with the adverse childhood experiences, right? And
Yeah, absolutely.
we're not setting ourselves up for a very prosperous future, I would think, here in Oklahoma. So what, all right, we always like to wrap these things up with suggestions for our listeners. What can rank and file Oklahomans do to try to help build momentum toward solutions in to these problems?
I think so. First of all, definitely support your direct service providers, your local homeless shelters and food pantries. Nonprofits are shouldering a large part of this burden as we continue to make cuts, and they are doing amazing work with really limited resources. So first of all, support your direct service providers so we can get folks what they need in these really hard times. Second of all, be talking to your local legislators. Your state representative and state senators, they are very accessible. You can email them. You can even schedule a meeting with them, but get to know your local leaders and talk to them about how housing instability and eviction and homelessness impacts your community. Legislators are receptive or should be receptive to their constituents and what is impacting their community. So they really need to be hearing from folks in their district what it means to their communities when we continue to not act on this issue of housing affordability and growing evictions.
Well, I'm just thinking that this whole topic is a less than sort of happy send-off into the holidays, but actually, I think as we all tool around for the holidays, I think we see so much evidence of the problem that is growing right before our eyes. And we may not see the long-term implications that you were talking about, but we will soon enough. And it's not a pretty picture for someone like me who has grandkids who are getting into high school and looking toward adulthood closely here for Oklahoma. But I think it's important for us to continue to kind of have these conversations and make people aware of what the heck's going on. So Sabina, thank you so much for joining us, and hope you'll join us again and we can continue the conversation in the future. You guys at OK Policy are doing great work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comforted. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just the resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.